Iku Iluna, please rise.
Ohea oko eko ka aha. Nahe kuleana ibua okea aha ho o kolo kolo ki ike hanohano o ka moko aina o Hawaii. I naui mai, i malio mai, i lohi ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and ye shall be heard. E noho I lalo. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 17-874. Rosalinda Gagner Saplin and Recto Ramos Saplin, the U.S. National Bank Association, as trustee for BAFC 2007A. Arguing for the petitioner, U.S. Bank, Jade Ching. Attorney Michelle Camo also appearing. Arguing for the respondents, the Saplins, Keith Kiyuchi. Argument on the merits.
All right, good afternoon, counsel. Are you ready to proceed? Both sides ready. All right, I just want to remind everyone our proceeding today is being broadcast live on our YouTube channel as well as on Olelo. I want to welcome and thank our substitute judges, Judge To'oto'o and Judge Ashford. We have 30 minutes for each side. Ms. Ching, you'll have 20 minutes. We'll give you a warning, 10 minutes reserved for rebuttal. Mr. Kiyuchi will give you a warning with 2 minutes to go. Very well, please proceed.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Rechtenwald, Justices McKenna and Eddins, Judges Ashford and To'oto'o. Pleased to be here to discuss the important legal issues raised in this matter. And on behalf of petitioner, myself and my colleagues who worked on this matter, we thank you for accepting this application. There are two primary issues raised in this application. Number one, whether a quiet title defendant, when moving for summary judgment, must meet Kondauer to negate or disprove plaintiff's title. And secondly, whether a dismissal under former rule, Circuit Court Rule 12Q, is an adjudication on the merits with prejudice for claim preclusion purposes when a Rule 58 judgment has not been entered and the factors enunciated by this court in Bagalay, In re Blaisdell, and Ryan v. Palmer were ignored and not considered. I'd like to first discuss quiet title burden of proof. In reaching its conclusion that U.S. Bank failed to meet its burden, the ICA grafted the Kondauer burdens onto U.S. Bank, even though, number one, it was never pled or argued by the Saplins, and number two, never raised or briefed on summary judgment and was not before Judge Crabtree or the defendants to consider. Instead, the Intermediate Court of Appeals independently raised Kondauer. And in the process, they upended the longstanding precedent regarding quiet title burdens, specifically Omerod, Maui Land and Pine, Pioneer Mill. These cases consistently hold that the burden of proof for quiet title purposes is the plaintiff's burden. And absent such proof, it is unnecessary for the defendant to make any such showing. Now, to be clear, U.S. Bank is not disputing Kondauer. We are not asking that Kondauer be overturned. We are arguing that Kondauer was improperly imposed in this case. Another component of being able to prove their title Plaintiff need not, as set forth in Maui Land and Pine, come forward with perfect title. Plaintiff only needs to prove that they have a substantial interest in the property that is superior to that of defendants, and in this case, U.S. Bank. That's all plaintiff needed to do in this case. Now, these burdens for quiet title need to be harmonized with the summary judgment burdens. The burdens of proof set forth in Ormerod, Pioneer Mill, and Maui Land and Pine are critical, and they work hand in hand on summary judgment. So while the U.S. Bank has a burden to prove that there's no question of fact and they're entitled to judgment as a matter of law, it can satisfy this burden as the defendant in quiet title by presenting evidence negating plaintiff's title, which is an element of the quiet title claim, or demonstrating that the plaintiff will be unable to meet its burden or carry its burden at trial. And that's what U.S. Bank did. It did just that. It used a mortgagee's quitclaim deed at summary judgment, which was Exhibit E. And it pointed out that the Saplin's quiet title claim, which was based on an administrative dismissal, a procedural dismissal under Rule 12Q, was not an adjudication under the merits.
What if that quitclaim deed was obtained under a flawed process under Condauer?
That's an interesting question, Judge.
That's why I asked.
The Saplins did not raise that. They didn't object to it. They didn't plead it. And unlike Matsuyoshi and Condauer, who did object to the nonjudicial foreclosure and who did state that there were defects in the nonjudicial foreclosure, that argument wasn't raised. That wasn't raised before Judge Crabtree on summary judgment. In fact, we used the quitclaim deed. The mortgagee's quitclaim deed was used, and there was no opposition to it. There were no objections to the mortgagee's quitclaim deed. Instead, the Saplins argued that the 12Q dismissal, the former Rule 12Q dismissal, was an adjudication on the merits. They argued claim preclusion. They were not arguing the Condauer burdens. They argued that was claim preclusion under Rule 12Q.
Claim preclusion or issue preclusion?
Judge, claim preclusion.
Which claim?
Precisely. There was a 2011 eviction action, and there was a dismissal under the former Rule 12Q. The Saplins argued in their four-page opposition that was claim preclusion.
The claim of what?
It was not articulated, Judge. Okay. It's U.S. Bank's position that they met their burden of proof, and therefore the burden shifted to the Saplins under Rule 56, and that they were required now to come forward with some kind of evidence that they did have superior title, or that there was a question of fact that could be presented at trial.
Are you saying that the burden should be on the Saplins to prove Condauer noncompliance?
If the Saplins had raised that, let me step back for a second.
Okay,
Justice, I
should have prefaced it. Let's say they had raised it.
Okay. If they had raised it, yes, I would argue that the Condauer burdens, that rubric, would be on the plaintiff. That would be the Saplins to argue that the nonjudicial foreclosure was not followed, that there was not strict compliance with the nonjudicial foreclosure statute, that there was some sort of infirmity in the nonjudicial foreclosure, and therefore they had superior title. But remember now, Justice Edens, that's not what they were arguing here. What they were arguing here was claim preclusion under the Rule 12Q dismissal. So the mortgagee's quitclaim deed was unobjected to, and they didn't raise any infirmities regarding the underlying nonjudicial foreclosure. That issue was not before the court. And the ICA's attempt now to superimpose these burdens of proof, in fact, shift the burdens of proof for the parties. Under the ICA's analysis, it now becomes the defendant's burden to prove Kondauer as though they were the plaintiff, even though they were not. They are the defendant, they are the defendants, the moving defendants. And all the defendant needed to do was negate an element of proof.
You're arguing that if that argument was going to be raised, it had to have been raised in the 2014 ejectment action, right?
Yes, Judge. The 2014 ejectment action, and at a minimum in the 2015, actually, it should have been raised in the 2015 action. It should have been raised in their 2015 complaint, in which they alleged quiet title. In the 2015 complaint, which is the judgment before this court, they raised quiet title, trespass, and under those circumstances, title is an element of proof for them. So if they were going to object to the manner in which the nonjudicial foreclosure had occurred, it would have been their burden to raise those arguments. They did not.
What's your response to their claim preclusion argument that the 2011 ejectment action, I guess, resolved title such that they have a claim or they're able to establish a claim vis-a-vis the bank?
I believe that 12Q dismissal, as this court has ruled many times in In Re Bagalay and more recently Arum, it is a high bar to achieve an adjudication on the merits.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, isn't Arum and Blaisdell, Ryan, aren't those cases where the party who got involuntarily dismissed, who sort of, like you, U.S. Bank, might have had an unhurried approach to things, moved to set aside within those 10-day period? Isn't that the distinction between those cases and your case, where U.S. Bank, for whatever reason, did not move to set aside?
I believe those cases also speak to Rule 41, Justice Edens. Under Arum and Bagalay, and including Ryan v. Palmer, in each of those cases, before the court, before this court reached the decision that it was an adjudication on the merits, the underlying court, the circuit court, had to consider the Rule 41b2 factors, which were analyzed in Arum, Bagalay, and even by the ICA in Ryan v. Palmer.
But how would it analyze the factors if the, you know, the party that was involuntarily dismissed wasn't around to show maybe that they were not dilatory?
And isn't that the problem that we have here? Because the ICA made this decision. They made this decision on the absence of a record. There's no analysis of the 41B2 factors of whether there was contumacious conduct, unreasonable delay. Was there actual prejudice to the defendant? Those factors were never analyzed. Rule 41 was ignored, completely ignored, and the ICA made a determination that this was an adjudication on the merits for claim preclusion purposes.
In what way was Rule 41B2 ignored?
There was no analysis of it by the circuit court, Chief Justice Rechtenwald. There's nothing in the record by any of below. There's an absence.
You're talking about the factors that were set forth in Arum and these other cases.
Yes,
correct?
I apologize.
So it's not the plain language of the rule. It's the judicial gloss
in these cases, correct?
That's correct, Judge. Okay. The factors that are enunciated by this court in those cases are not present in the record. Yet, even though they were not present, the ICA determined that this was an adjudication on the merits.
What, does that, in effect, invalidate the rules provision that says it can be dismissed, but notice shall be given, and there's, within 10 days, a motion is set aside, can be filed for good cause shown? I mean, why doesn't that address the concern that you have, which is there's a process to come forward and argue the factors? Otherwise, in essence, you're arguing for the invalidation of the rule because the court's not going to be in a position to balance those factors. So the rule sets forth the process where the court can get the ball rolling, but then the party who's subject to the dismissal can come back.
I think that Rule 12Q and the former Rule 12F and now the present Rule 12I are harmonized with Rule 41B2. In this case, there was no judgment that was entered. So had a judgment been entered, there would have been, I think we wouldn't be in this situation. There would be those arguments. There would be the post-judgment Rule 59, Rule 60 arguments that would address the concerns that are being raised today.
Our case law is pretty clear that res judicata, collateral estoppel only apply after a final judgment and the appeals process has been exhausted. And Price versus Obayashi is very clearly holds that a Rule 58 final judgment is required even on a 12Q dismissal for there to be, an appeal. So technically, after an appeal enters on the 20, after a final judgment enters on the 2011 action, you could still appeal that technically. But my question is a little bit more fundamental. Do you really think that Rule 41B3 was intended to apply to dismissals under Rule 12, 28, and 29 of the rules of the circuit courts, which do not have that adjudication on the merits language? If the ICA's ruling is upheld here, look at Rule 28. A plaintiff doesn't serve a complaint within 6 months. Case can be dismissed. You can file a motion to set it aside within, but so let's say there's a pro se plaintiff, files a complaint, defendant is evading service, can't serve the complaint, court orders dismissal under Rule 28, and now we're going to apply 41B3, even though Rule 28 doesn't have that language. Rule 12, 28, and 29 do not have that language. Candidly, I was a circuit court trial judge for many years, did many 12Q, Rule 12, 12H, 12Q, 28, 29 dismissals. I don't think I ever envisioned that that was going to be with prejudice.
Justice McKenna, you've invited me down a path that I agree that the 12-Q dismissal should not be with prejudice. It gives the circuit court expansive powers, and we see that in this case with the ICA's decision. In this case, U.S. Bank's case was dismissed a couple of months before the Ryan v. Palmer decision. And I believe U.S. Bank understood the 12Q dismissal because Rule 12 had been amended and it didn't include the with prejudice language. It was previously Rule 12F that had included this dismissal is with prejudice. It is then later amended in 2007, and the with dismissal with prejudice is unlimited. We don't get the with prejudice language until Ryan v. Palmer, which is enunciated by the ICA shortly after the 2011 dismissal. Their entire analysis is premised upon 12Q is a dismissal with prejudice. I would put to this court that
that was a mistake because it does give the court expansive powers.
How is that just? Rule one of the HRCP says that the rules are supposed to be construed for the, you know, the just and speedy and inexpensive. How is it just, based on Ryan and Arum, to have this become a dismissal with prejudice on the merits for basically technical violations?
I don't believe it is.
Can I ask you this, too? If you look at the rule, 41B3, that is, and how it reads is, you know, dismissal under this subdivision and any dismissal not provided for in this rule. Does that refer to the rules of civil procedure only, or also the court rules like Justice McKenna's talking about?
You know, I think it's not clear because there's language that states that this rule trumps, that the rules of civil procedure, to the extent it conflicts with the circuit court rules, the rules of civil procedure trumps the circuit court rules. I think we have to go back to, I think we have to go back and look at Ryan v. Palmer, which started with the premise that the 12Q dismissal is a dismissal with prejudice, even though the language of the rule didn't state that. It didn't state that. And so very quickly, was this an adjudication on the merits? What was decided? The 2011 action was an eviction action. What was decided? Was title decided? Was title decided in favor of the Saplins? The Saplins had not filed a counterclaim. There was nothing there to be decided vis-a-vis their title to the property. Was final judgment entered? No, final judgment had not been entered.
Let me ask you about that. You know, and you refer to it in your cert application that, you know, you always need a Rule 58 judgment for 41B dismissals. So if we ruled in your favor on those grounds, essentially you could appeal that 2011 ejectment action now, or virtually now then, right?
Technically, yes. If a final judgment is entered, if a final judgment is never entered in the 2011 action, it's a nullity. It's just sitting there.
So you could then appeal the 2011 ejectment action if we ruled in your favor and after final judgment from this court.
Justice Edens, what I'm hoping that you'll do is you will affirm Judge Crabtree's summary judgment and vacate the ICA's mm-hmm. opinion.
And just to clarify, I mean, your basic point is this case really wasn't actually litigated. The quiet title wasn't actually litigated. And that it has nothing to do with the ejectment action. In other words, there's no preclusion.
Oh yeah, there's no preclusion.
Isn't that your number one point?
Right, and there's no adjudication on the merits. And we are concerned with the dismissal with prejudice.
Why is there no adjudication on the merits?
Because the Rule 41B2 analysis factors under Bagley and Arum had not been considered.
Wasn't the time to raise them in the 10-day period that the court offered the bank in which to object and show good cause? And you didn't take, the bank didn't do that, correct?
That's correct. The bank did not do that.
So having passed on that opportunity, here we are years later and the bank is saying this is unfair. You should have, the court should have somehow intuited what these factors were in this case? That's kind of your position.
No, Justice Rechtenwald, that is not my position. My position is the Bagley factors had not been met, and it was inappropriate for the ICA to determine that this was an adjudication on the merits without entry of a separate Rule 58 final judgment, which amounted to claim preclusion.
That is your alternative argument.
Correct.
You're first arguing that 41B3 doesn't even apply to a 12Q dismissal.
If Rule 12Q is going to be read as a dismissal with prejudice, the 41B factors need to first be considered before you can reach a determination that's an adjudication on the merits.
Okay. All right.
You cannot have a process where notice is given to the party and they're given 10 days to come in and meet the relatively generous standard of good cause. That's that part of the statute's invalidated under your approach, correct?
If we were to ignore the 10-day, the
statute sets forth a process where the ball gets rolling, the court sua sponte dismisses, but it's required to give notice and give an opportunity to the party to come in the 10 days, and your client didn't take advantage of that opportunity. Why isn't that the end of the discussion?
It is the end of the discussion, except that the IC has determined that this was a dismissal, the 2011 action was a dismissal with prejudice and an adjudication on the merits for quiet title purposes, when there was actually no claim that was actually decided and actually determined in that case. The Soplons had not counterclaimed for title.
That's a bit of a different issue. So a narrower version of what the 2011 action was an action for ejectment and not one to quiet title, correct?
That's correct.
Right.
Right. So, okay. So I'm just wondering who cares really about dismissal with or without prejudice when it's the ejectment that has no preclusive effect on the quiet title. So who really cares? Does it matter on whether it's with or without if the ejectment has no preclusive effect?
We care because of the language that's used in the ICA's opinion that can be cited to by practitioners and litigants and used in the future to suggest that you have no final judgment entered and there is claim preclusion. There is a preclusive effect based upon a Rule 12Q administrative procedural dismissal.
So it has nothing really to do with U.S. Bank's position. You're just talking, it's just a sort of a general clarification type of decision we should have. Because again, I don't see whether that even matters to your particular issues. Does it? I mean, maybe it does. It just seems ejectment has nothing to do with quiet title.
In this case, the Soplons asserted in the 2015 case and the summary judgment that's before the court, the Soplons asserted quiet title and ejectment. And title is an element of both of those claims. So I do believe that the ICA's language that they superimposed, and there was really no analysis regarding claim preclusion in that section of their opinion, would impact U.S. Bank, because there's a statement in there that it was claim preclusion. Essentially, title is decided in favor of the Soplons. So standing alone, that's a dangerous statement sitting there in their opinion.
But your client could have avoided that by objecting within the 10 days. There's nothing in the record to explain, suggest they didn't get notice or somehow were precluded from making an objection during that 10-day period?
No, there's nothing in the record regarding the 2011.
But our case law is pretty clear that for there to be any res judicata or collateral estoppel effect, there has to be a appealable final judgment. And Hawaii state law differs from federal law in that federal law, there is res judicata effect at the time of the trial court judgment, but our cases hold that there is no res judicata or collateral estoppel effect until the appeals process has been exhausted. Therefore, if there's no final judgment, then there's been no right to appeal yet. So therefore, no matter what, there can be no collateral estoppel or res judicata effect based on the 2011 dismissal.
Right? I think that's correct, Judge. I think that's the Price v. Obayashi decision and longstanding.
Beamer versus Sweet, Dorrance versus Lee, many cases, Eastern Bank, Eastern Savings versus Esteban.
It's longstanding jurisprudence. Yes, that's correct. There was no final judgment entered in this case.
Is appealability the same as claim preclusive effect?
I think
under the restatement.
Raymer versus Weeks. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Why don't you answer my question?
I think in order
are those
for
things, are they the same?
I think
I guess your position is they are correct.
So for it to be final and appealable, there needs to be entry of a final judgment. And
we don't follow the restatement. In other words, Bremer versus Weeks requires four factors. Issue has to be identical. There was a final judgment. The issue decided was essential, and the party was in privity. So there is no final judgment here, right?
There was no final judgment.
Would you like to reserve your time for rebuttal at this point or anything further?
Nothing further at this time. Yes, please. Thank you.
Kurt, were you going to change the mic? Or?
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices Edens and McKenna, Judges Ashford and Tolotol, thank you for this opportunity to address this case for the supplants. And I think that's the correct pronunciation. I want to first start with the issue of the dismissal under 41B3, because I would distinguish the Ryan B. Palmer case primarily because that was a case where it was a 12Q dismissal. But what happened was the plaintiff in that case, it's a personal injury case, filed an objection to the dismissal within the 10-day period. And the presiding judge, Judge Liu, disagreed and denied the setting aside of the dismissal. So you have a totally different scenario than you have here.
And did the judge make it a dismissal with prejudice in that case? I can't remember.
It did. I mean, okay. It was effectively a dismissal with prejudice because they were running up against the statute of limitations deadline because of the 2-year tort deadline. So it's a dismissal, whether it was with or without prejudice in that case, would not have made a difference. But what happened was the attorney that was subjected to the dismissal, Mr. Toma, then asked for a 54B certification, and then he took it up. That's why the Bagley factors, which are described in Ryan V. Palmer, come into play, because he did do the objection within the 10-day period. Here, what makes a world of difference is, as Chief Justice said, the plaintiff, U.S. Bank, had the opportunity to object within the 10-day period. They could have said anything about why they didn't proceed with the case, but they didn't object. The fact that they didn't object takes it out of the Ryan V. Palmer, takes it out of Bagley, certainly takes it out of Blaisdell, because Blaisdell is a totally different case. Blaisdell deals with contumacious conduct and whether you have that finding. So I would argue here, it should be restricted to the fact that U.S. Bank did not take advantage. They got the notice. There's no evidence they didn't get the notice. And they didn't object within the 10 days.
But you are requesting res judicata or collateral estoppel effect, right?
That is what was argued, unfortunately, in the opening brief. At the very least, you got claim preclusion. But, you know, I think
but either way, our case law is very clear. You need there's no res judicata effect until there's a final judgment. Price versus Obayashi says you need a 58. Jenkins versus Kate Shetty applies to 12Q dismissals. And Glover is, you know, since Glover, we've held that a final judgment, a judgment is final where the time to appeal has expired without appeal being taken.
Sure.
And therefore, there's no, the right to appeal has not even been triggered here because there's no final judgment.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, if I had done the opening brief, would have done a very open.
Okay, so you're conceding that issue now then.
Yeah, I'm conceding that issue. But I think I want to emphasize, because it's got applicability in other cases, in a lot of foreclosure cases, where what happens is the foreclosing lender doesn't object within the 10-day period. So what's the legal effect? And I think 41B3 makes it very clear that it operates as an adjudication on the merits.
Does it, though, when the rules of the circuit court don't contain that language? And I had forgotten about the 2007 amendment where it where the with prejudice language on 12F was had been eliminated. So what is the intent of the rules of the circuit court? It seems to me that it's more like an administrative way to, you know, like clear cases and just clear out the dead cases that are not moving along, but it was never intended to be an adjudication on the merits as per HRCP dismissals under 41 and or 37 or perhaps, you know, other types of dismissals.
It might be, I have another case where this issue came up and I tried to do some research on the history and there wasn't any history I could really grab a hold of it except what Ms. Ching mentioned. But the language is there. I mean, the language is clear as day. It operates as an adjudication on the merits.
But does it intended to apply to the rules of the circuit courts that came after HRCP? Or was it only intended to apply to dismissals under the HRCP?
I think that it does, because I think that the Hawaii Rules of Civil Procedure, I think, take priority or precedence over the
So if a Rule 28 dismissal, if an objection is not filed for failure to serve the complaint within, if an objection is not filed within 10 days, the case is gone.
Arguably, that might be the case, but then
if the defendant somehow appears and somebody files a, or the court decides to file a final judgment.
But I think the safeguard in all of those cases is there's notice. You've given notice to a party that, you know, if they object to the dismissal, they can object within 10 days. And as this court has just pointed out, that bar is not a real high bar. That's a low bar. I mean, all you got to do is show good cause.
But what if the parties or the attorneys had been assuming that all of these dismissals were without prejudice? And rather than file a dismissal, you know, file the objection within 10 days, say for a Rule 28 failure to serve dismissal, they decide, okay, we're going to try to do a little bit more research. We're going to hire a private investigator, try to find the defendant, try to find a better address to serve the defendant.
Or you simply file a motion to extend time to serve the complaint. And that's the objection you can file within the 10-day period. I mean, the practitioner, I mean, once you read Ryan v. Palmer, it should scare practitioners, because if that dismissal went through, you potentially have a malpractice claim against the attorney that didn't comply. So I think it behooves a party that gets the 10-day dismissal to pay attention to it. I mean, that's the problem every practitioner has, but you've got to calendar that and you've got to look at it. And that's a problem that comes up in these cases.
But even if the Rule 12, 28, and 29 don't have that adjudication on the merits language that exists in 41B3.
But 41B3 has it really plain. Again, I don't know.
How plain is it? It says rule, you know, this subdivision or other rule.
And any dismissal not provided for in the rule. A dismissal under this subdivision and any dismissal not provided for in this rule. That's what it specifically says. And again, I mean, I have this come up in another case. I went back and looked. There is no, unlike a statute, there is no legislative history. There's no history or background to say, what this resulted from. The one other thing I want to address, I understand what you're saying, Justice McKenna, absolutely about a final judgment. But, you know, in Ryan v. Palmer, the attorney had the wherewithal to ask for 54B certification. And there are dismissals that occur under a different section, like 41A1B, that don't need a separate judgment. And I'll quote to the Amantiad v. Odom case, 90 Hawaii 152. So it's not like every dismissal under Rule 41 in the subsets.
What year is that case?
That is a 1999 case, 90 Hawaii 152. So not, I think my point is that not every single dismissal under 41B requires a separate judgment. And I understand the Price v. Obayashi analysis, and certainly that is controlling. I don't disagree with Ms. Ching that the issues that were raised regarding
I'm sorry, excuse me. Yeah. Let me step back based on your last comment. So if it doesn't, If perhaps what you're saying is the 41B3 motion itself shows finality.
Right. That's right.
Okay. That would be then one of the purposes of 41B3. But isn't that, I guess, on the merits language, perhaps showing, okay, that triggers maybe an appeal, like you're saying. But how does that show issue preclusion, like it was actually litigated?
So arguably, you know, where this would come up, for example, is like on a foreclosure case. So let's say you had filed a foreclosure complaint and you got a 12Q dismissal. I would argue that precludes refiling the foreclosure complaint. That's what I would argue.
Under claim preclusion.
Right, correct.
Issue under, preclusion, right?
Right, correct. Under claim preclusion. That's what I would argue.
But so is that a just decision? I mean, Rule 1 says these rules are supposed to be construed to be just. So you're saying that if they miss it by, you know, one day, then the mortgagor can live in the house forever with no foreclosure. Is that just?
It may not be just, but it's also a requirement that, again, you know, notice is given. It's not like notice isn't given. They have the opportunity to object, and it's not, you know, they can object within 10 days. So it's not an onerous burden that's placed on the party to simply file an objection. And I agree that it's not a final judgment, but I do think that there's an argument for claim preclusion. So I want to move to the other issue that that's been raised, which is really what is the standard on the motion for summary judgment. I don't disagree that Mr. Dubin's office and Mr. Arnsmeyer didn't raise it in the opening brief, really in some respect didn't raise it in the memorandum in opposition to the motion for summary judgment, which is a 5-page memorandum. But I think the argument is that Kondauer should still apply. And as the ICA pointed out, and I agree with the ICA decision, that because Kondauer applies, that transaction, which is a quitclaim deed, is voidable. So I think that's what the ICA had in mind. And I would argue in this specific case that it was voidable. This is a situation where the sale price was never shown to be reasonable. There was still back then the requirement that they had to put in the affidavit that the sale price was reasonable. And that didn't happen in this case. So I think the argument can be made that the quitclaim deed was certainly voidable. And this was pled as a quiet title action. In a quiet title action, you can argue that the supplants are saying, hey, I have superior title to U.S. Bank because the quitclaim deed was void, because that your non-judicial foreclosure was void. So I think that argument could easily be made that the quitclaim deed was void and therefore the supplants its superior title. The other thing that is pled in the complaint is a claim of unjust enrichment. And that was really never addressed if you look at Judge Crabtree's minutes. Really never addressed in the motion, in his minute order in the motion for summary judgment. Well, I think regardless, you have an unjust enrichment claim. And that, I think, was properly pled because the way that reads is that if they cannot undo the sale to the third-party purchaser, that U.S. Bank should be responsible for an unjust enrichment claim. And an unjust enrichment claim has to stand by itself. And the Porter v. Hu, if you have an unjust enrichment claim, you don't have any other, you can only do that if you don't have any other remedies. So I would point that out. The last thing I want to say, I guess going back to Judge Crabtree's minute order, it struck me that he determined that the dismissal was an adjudication on the merits. If you look at the minute order, and I look very carefully at that, and I think he was right about that. So unless you have any other questions, that's
all. Could you explain that last point again? I'm sorry.
He specifically said in his minute order that he felt that under Rule 41B3, that it wasn't adjudication on the merits. And he specifically put that in his minute order.
Right, but you're conceding that even if that's what the rule says, for there to be collateral estoppel or res judicata effect, which is what he was doing there,
right?
There but, had to have been a final judgment. Right,
I agree. But then you still can make the claim preclusion argument. Thank you.
No, you need a final judgment for a claim preclusion or both claim preclusion and issue preclusion. A final judgment is required, right?
Yes.
Okay. And you argued that Amantillado versus Odom stands for the proposition that you don't always have to have a final
judgment. Correct.
Right, but that was a 41A stipulation
different
for dismissal with prejudice,
right,
which an order is not required. So that is a really limited exception. And it doesn't apply to involuntary dismissals under Rule 41B.
I understand that, but my argument is you don't need a separate judgment for every dismissal under Rule 41.
Only when there's no court order that's even required
Correct.
For a dismissal to be effective.
Correct.
It's kind of strange to be appealing a stipulation for dismissal with prejudice.
It would be very strange, but yeah.
Mr. Chiocci, before you exit, because I think you're about to
yes.
the podium earlier. Earlier, I think you in essence said that Kandauer essentially says that the quitclaim deed is voidable. Is that accurate?
Actually, it's Del Pena that said that it's voidable and not void, which is Ms. Ching's case.
Okay. So if it's voidable on a summary judgment motion filed by the bank, what is the bank's burden with respect to the issue of it's voidable?
I think once you assert that the quitclaim deed was voidable, then the bank has to overcome that.
And when was that asserted?
It wasn't.
So then what is the burden on summary judgment if it's not asserted?
Well, in summary judgment, I would argue, look at the entire record to determine whether or not there's a genuine issue of material fact. But I understand what you're saying, and I don't necessarily disagree.
I think Ms. Ching's argument, sorry to interrupt you,
yeah.
long ago was sort of twofold about what the ICA did with respect to not the race judicata issue. But I think she said, one, that the ICA improperly grafted Kandauer onto quiet title, and two, the issue wasn't even raised below at the circuit court level. She didn't use any phraseology here, but I think in essence she was saying either it's unfair for the ICA to bring it up sua sponte or it was waived below. Do you have any opinion about any of that?
I have scoured through this because I didn't draft the original pleadings, obviously. I can't disagree with that, frankly.
Well, do you think it cannot be raised by the ICA, for example, because it wasn't raised below?
I think it can be raised by the ICA if they felt that it was not fair and equitable for the motion to be granted. I think that it can be raised at that point if they felt that there was an issue such as the quitclaim deed being invalid or did not meet the standard Kandauer. I respectfully disagree with Ms. Ching that they simply grafted that on. I think that anytime you've got a non-judicial foreclosure, I think that the standard should be met on showing how that met the requirements of Kandauer and later on Hungate v. Rosa.
So that's an affirmative obligation of the party who's relying on title via a quitclaim
yes.
deed.
Yeah, I would argue that's definitely the case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Was there a final judgment on the 2014 ejectment action?
Yeah, there was. There was a, I actually wrote it down. There was on August 21st, 2014, judgment for possession, writ of possession that was entered. So there was a final judgment.
That's
on
right,
that
judgment
by
for
contrast.
Possession. Right, right.
But
an appealable
was,
judgment.
Right,
right.
But that was a really strange case because Mr. and Mrs. Saplan, who are the plaintiffs here, got dismissed very early on. So that judgment only applied to the son and the son's significant other.
So you are arguing lack of privity?
Yes, absolutely lack. I think that's the one thing that was argued down below and up above that was absolutely correct, that 2014 doesn't apply because that was lack of privity. So, yes.
Thank you.
Anything further? Very well, thank you. Ms. Ching, your rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Kiyuchi argues somehow that Kandauer was implicated and was raised in the Saplan's complaint. And I believe he points to the fact that they pled quiet title and they pled unjust enrichment. Now, I have the verified complaint here. There's nothing in here to suggest that the Saplans are claiming anything other than claim preclusion in this complaint. There's nothing in here that would suggest or would even meet the Rule 8 notice pleading standards. No stretch of the imagination could anyone suggest that this complaint was complaining about a mortgagee's quitclaim deed or the fact that the nonjudicial foreclosure was somehow infirm. These arguments were not before the court. They were not before Judge Crabtree. They were not raised by the Saplans. The Saplans' MIO and their complaint was specifically about claim preclusion. To now come here before the court, and I can understand why, but it's inappropriate to suggest that this complaint somehow did.
You reached your 30 minutes. I'm going to give you a few minutes to wrap up, but your time is up. But I will give you a few more minutes because we were asking a lot of questions during the end of your opening. That's what. By our count, your 30 minutes is up, but I'm going to give you a little extra time.
I apologize. I thought I had reserved 10 minutes.
You cut into that time. You actually went up to 28 minutes, I think. So I'll give you a couple minutes because we were asking you a lot of questions. I want to be sure you get your arguments out, but I'd say, you know, make sure you focus on the big ones at this point.
Thank you, Judge. And I will conclude at this point that the summary judgment burdens and the burdens of proof vis-a-vis quiet title, as discussed, were put in place as guardrails, and therefore practitioners to follow. The ICA's decision veers off course and down a very dangerous path that eviscerates this court's longstanding jurisprudence on quiet title burdens and summary judgment burdens. And
Mr. Chief Justice, may I ask one additional
question?
Oh,
no, I'm not trying to rush. Okay, you sure you have time and everyone else has time?
I have one additional question. It's a little bit unclear to me what you are seeking here. Are you seeking entry? You're seeking reinstatement of Judge Crabtree's decision, except for the portion of his decision in which he said that the dismissal was an adjudication on the merits.
The adjudication on the merits, Justice McKenna, is set forth in his minute order.
Okay, it wasn't in his actual order.
That's correct. Okay. The adjudication on the merits is set forth in the ICA's opinion.
Okay.
So what we're asking for is that the ICA's opinion be vacated and Judge Crabtree's order be affirmed. And with that, I will conclude.
Let me do it. In regard to his concession that a final judgment was needed, where does that leave us from the point of view of the bank? Does that provide the answer that you need in terms of getting to the outcome you want?
The ultimate outcome that would be that there would be no claim preclusion, but that still leaves the 12Q dismissal. If the ICA's decision is not vacated, I could see practitioners citing to that decision and suggesting that you don't need a final judgment for
claim preclusion purposes. So we would argue, or we would request that the ICA's decision be vacated in its entirety and Judge Crabtree's order affirmed.
Very well. Thank you for your arguments. For both our attorneys, the court will take this matter under advisement.
Eku iluna, please rise. Ua ho'oku ia mai ne kea aha. Ho'okolokolo ki eke hanohano. Okamoku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.